On this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, I sit down with John Kasem to uncover multifamily today.
Hey, Mavericks. This is Ava Baukamp, and this episode of Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks is brought to you by Legacy Impact Investors. We are an industrial investment firm located in cash flow country, the Midwest. We strive to shield off risk and beat inflation, all while producing predictable cash flow. We curate real estate investment opportunities for busy professionals and other real estate investors seeking passive income. To learn more about what we do and connect with me, go to www.legacyimpactinvestors.com.
Maverick, noun, unusual person, a visionary, leader, go-getter, an independent thinker. They see the vision for their life and pull that future towards them. With an unyielding belief that things can and must be better, they achieve what most won't. Innovative, influential, daring, and direct, with a remarkably high tolerance for taking calculated risk. A foe to the status quo. This is Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks. Your host, Neil Timmons, has been involved with over $300 million in real estate transactions. He's a published author, commercial property investor, and real estate syndicator. This show is for those who want to learn how to earn passive income through real estate investing. Now, here's your host, Neil Timmons.
Welcome to Passive Real Estate Investing with Mavericks, where we provide you actionable steps to grow your passive income and become job optional. During this episode, you're going to get to discover multifamily today. For those of you who are new, I'm your host, Neil Timmons. I love passive income from real estate. Before I introduce you to today's Maverick, I want to make a request that at any point during our episode, you like what you hear, well, give us a thumbs up. Be certain to subscribe to the show. Never miss a valuable episode. If you love what you hear, give us a written review. Plus, be sure to look at the description of this episode. We packed it with thousands of dollars in free resources. Now, today, we've got the privilege to learn from a person who's got over a decade's experience in multifamily syndications. Prior to his career in real estate, he was working for General Motors. All of it changed when General Motors filed for bankruptcy back in that day. And ultimately, that was the kick that he needed to know that he needed a plan B. Now, we describe today's Maverick, someone who's absolutely passionate about making sure that he's taking care of passive investors and understanding where his floor is. He's got an interesting perspective when he identifies the risk in a deal. Today's Maverick, I've got John Kasem here with me. John, how are you?
Neil, I'm excited to be here, man. It's a great day. It's a beautiful day, and excited to be here with you and your audience.
I'm excited to have you here. Say, for the audience's sake, who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
Yeah, who am I, man? That's an easy question and also a complicated question, but I am a multifamily investor, I guess, for the intents and purpose of this audience. But I think first and foremost, I see myself as a father. I'm a dad of two boys, very smart, sweet, athletic boys. They tend to fight from time to time, but we're working on that. So I spend a lot of my time with them and my wife as well. I started investing in multifamily back in 2016. I started a smaller residential multifamily back in 2012. And I come from corporate America. So like many of your listeners, I had a W-2 job, corporate America. I was working in marketing. I worked for General Motors. I worked for different advertising agencies. I helped work on some of the largest campaigns. I haven't done a Super Bowl campaign, but I've done almost everything else. So I've done New Year's Eve celebrations at Times Square for the Pontiac brand. I've done Super Bowl activations. I've done a lot of TV campaigns. I've worked with Nike, Coors Light, Mountain Dew, all those different big brands. And for me, the way real estate came into the fold was I was at GM when we went through bankruptcy. So I saw that firsthand and I witnessed it. And my father worked at a Buick dealership when I was a kid. So it was kind of full circle that I was at headquarters working in marketing at GM and actually ended up working on the Buick brand. So it was kind of definitely a full circle story. But my dad's a life. He's one of those dudes who get a good job, you work there and keep your head down and you go to work every single day and you bleeding, you got shot, doesn't matter. Like, just go to work, right? He's like old school blue collar kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I obviously didn't see the world the same way. I watched, you know, him on strike at times. Your workers went on strike. I've watched. But again, this dude wake up every single day and pretty much go to work. When I went through bankruptcy with that company, I just watched the anxiety it created with everyone, me included. But at that time, I had no kids. I didn't have a wife. So, yeah. I mean, worst case for me is I'd just go get another job. But for the people who had families, it was intense and very stressful. And I had a lot of time to think. And as I was thinking and just looking and trying to emulate, like, okay, if I made it up to this level, if I got to this director level, if I got that job, it'll be okay. And then I'm like, no, that person's miserable. Do you see them every day? Like, they're even worse. Like, this person cannot sleep at night. And I just realized that I needed a plan B, and real estate ultimately became that plan B for me. And we've been investing for, like I said, over a decade now. We've helped other people invest as well alongside of us, and we've helped them invest over $100 million worth of apartments. So hopefully that answers your questions. I know I kind of...
Absolutely. And there's a lot that we get to unpack as a result of that. That's very helpful. Take me back to the very first apartment deal that you did, not the small ones, but the actual first multifamily deal. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So I'll tell you the first commercial deal, and then I'll tell you the first larger syndication deal, right? So the first commercial deal was an 8-unit property in Chicago. It was around $628,000 was the acquisition price. Exactly. I think we put down about $130,000 for that deal. And the reason this was important is we had done a couple smaller deals, but the vision and the pathway became kind of clear. So I kind of alluded to the fact that while I was at GM, I realized that I needed a plan B.
Right.
This deal was really my first test, right? I was starting to do some real estate, but what I realized is I wasn't generating enough cash flow to take care of me and my family. Now I had the two boys at that point. I didn't have enough cash flow if I were to lose my job. So now I was like, okay, well, how do I scale this? Well, to scale, you either have to buy a lot of small properties or you need to buy larger properties. So this was a test. I hired a property management company, which was required. And we did okay on that deal. We learned some lessons. We tried out some things. Everything up to that point, we self-managed. So this was the first time I was working with third-party management. But I would say it also was intended to be a springboard for something bigger. I didn't want to go into a larger apartment deal without saying that, hey, I've worked on commercial real estate. I've worked with a third-party management company. So that was really the intention of that deal. So with that in mind, I would say it served its purpose. The next deal took some time. We were hunting for deals. We were looking for deals. And the biggest thing that I learned was my return projections were very different when I was looking to work with other investors versus when it was just me. Mm. When it was just me, if it cash flowed or made an 8% return, great, perfect. But when you start thinking about giving 50, 60, 70, maybe even 80% of the profits to those investors, mm-hmm. and now you only got 20 to maybe 40 or 50% for yourself, well, the numbers start to dwindle a little bit there. It's like, sure. Man, this is a whole lot of work to make $10 or whatever it is, right?
Right.
So we had a hard time finding deals that we felt penciled based on the in-place cash flow and the upside potential. So after some time in networking and talking to multiple people, I actually made a great connection at a conference. And it took about 6 or 7 months. And I'll tell you about the power of podcasting. I ended up launching my podcast, which is now Multifamily Insights. At that time, was called Target Market Insights. And the second guest I had on, right? Guest number two, talking to him. And he was the guy I met at a conference. I was really clear, like the kind of people I want to talk to early. And I had him on. And after we record, I'm like, hey, that was great. Love talking to you and learning more about your market. And at that time, his market was San Antonio. And after the show, we just said, hey, man, well, listen, if you're ever working on anything and need some help, I'm having a hard time finding deals, but I like you. I've known you for some time now. I like the way you operate. I love how intelligent you are, the way you approach the business. So I'd be happy to work with you. And he said, well, I may have something cooking, but I'll keep you posted. And about 2 weeks later, he said, hey, man, I've got something. Are you still interested in working together? And I said, absolutely. Send it over. And we ended up taking a look at that deal. We liked it. And for me, the thing that was incredible for me, because I'm typically a pretty reserved person. I know it may not seem like it, but I am a pretty reserved person. And I overanalyze everything. And the thing that was really good and comforting for me was he and I had just done this interview where we talk all about the San Antonio market. So like, if you go back and listen to that show, we break it down. We talk about the corridors and where the growth is happening, what's driving growth. So when he sent me the deal, I already knew the market stuff from that conversation. I was up to speed, so I could just look at really the numbers and already knew him and liked him. So I felt really comfortable with that and liked his background. So all I had to do was really analyze the deal, the business plan, the metrics that were in there. And that made it easy for me to pull the trigger and then work with him as a partner, bring some of my investors into this deal, help them with some of the other market analysis elements. And that was 192 units. So I went from an 8-unit deal, which was my 8-unit commercial deal that we led to, this 192 unit as a general partner. So I think it was really important for me to just be open-minded with how we did a deal, because in the past I was so fixated on, I've got to do it all. I got to find the deal. I got to manage the deal. I got to raise all the capital for the deal. And that's what I was doing for about a year. And we just couldn't find one that worked. So once I opened up my approach to say, well, maybe I can work with people that I really respect and I really like. And he just happened to be one of those people.
Yep.
That gave us a chance to do this larger 192 unit deal.
Well, it certainly, the industry certainly lends itself to a team sport mentality, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Bring me current. Tell me about the most recent deal.
Yeah. So we are, let's see here, the most recent one, I'm trying to think technically speaking.
I know you got things in the hopper and what
have
just closed
on something. Yeah, we got stuff in the hopper. Yes.
However you want to describe it in your mind, it's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll speak on the one that is okay for me to talk about more freely. So we did a 100 unit deal in Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, it's in a smaller submarket called Douglasville. So we did that in February of this year. My little hesitation is we actually closed another deal in Columbus, but we've decided we're going to bring on some LPs even after we close. So that's what we're going to work on there. So I won't talk about that one as much. But both deals are really interesting deals because we're trying to work on our partnerships. And for us, that's one of the things in this business is making sure you're aligned with the right people. Mm-hmm. So our Douglasville deal is an affordable housing play, which I've been very intrigued by. We all see these stats that talk about how affordable or unaffordable housing is in this country,
right?
And something needs to be done about it, right? And we see rents are going up and up and up, and that's great for real estate investors, but ultimately, you know, someone has to pay that price, and our renters, they can only afford so much.
That's right.
So we wanted to learn a lot more about affordable housing, and this deal presented an opportunity to do that in a market that's great. It's growing. We have multiple options of how we can create value for our partners, and that's one that we're really excited about. So that's a deal there where for us, what we're hoping is this opens us up to more opportunities and to be of greater value to not just our investing partners and our LP partners, but also to the community. If we understand better how to navigate these deals,
sure,
there may be more opportunities we can be a part of. Because we've passed on deals where there was a LIHTC, so a low-income housing tax credit component, just because we didn't understand it that thoroughly. We weren't comfortable getting into something that we didn't fully understand. So that's the deal I'm excited about. We've been operating this for about 6 months now, and I've been on all the asset management calls with the team, and there's definitely a lot in that process to make sure all your paperwork is there and everyone's getting approved through the system the right way.
Yeah.
But it's been very educational.
It may be an apartment, but it is different. Once you go and cross that threshold from the low income, there's a lot of regulatory compliance that goes into that to make sure you're doing exactly everything by the book.
Absolutely. So that's what we're excited about and just where that can take us. And then the other one is a partnership that we're excited about because this is a group that they have a really nice footprint in the market of Columbus, Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
So I'm in Cincinnati. Columbus is a little bit more than an hour and a half away from me. And it's easy for us to get to. And they've got a really nice foothold there. And we want to have deep partnerships. So our whole goal right now is to develop really deep partnerships with a small group of people who we believe in, because that's what it takes, right? The properties are the properties, but ultimately it comes down to the execution of the business plan. And we've got to have world-class partners in order to do that. So we're excited about this opportunity. This partner has already demonstrated the ability to execute. One of the comp properties we were looking at for this property was actually a property they owned, managed, and sold. So they've already really run the play, and we're just going to run it back on this new asset. So I'm excited about that.
So in between the 8-plex and your most recent ones, there's a lot of things you learned along the way. What are the top 2 or 3 things you learned along the way?
I think the biggest one is figure out what you're really good at. And it's okay to admit that you're not great at everything. We go to school and you want to be a straight A student, right? You want to get an A in science, an A in English, an A in math. Yeah. The reality is, in the real world, you're probably not an A student in everything, right? So what are you really good at? And then find those A students in other areas and let them take on some of those responsibilities. And I think real estate investors operate as solo entrepreneurs, especially when you're starting out in the residential space, right? It's like, you got to do it all, right? And people pride themselves on being a handyman and being a landlord and all this other stuff. And it's like, listen, that's not how you run a business, right? If you want to scale a business, you have to bring on people who can take on specific roles. And I go back to my time in corporate America. I just felt like one day it was an aha moment of something that was pretty clear and obvious. It's like when I worked at GM, my job was marketing. I didn't go to the finance guys and try to tell them what we should be selling these vehicles for, right? I didn't go to the design and engineers and tell them, hey, you need to be making it look like this.
Right.
Everybody had their job. Everybody had their role. So when we get into real estate, it's a similar thing. You, as a CEO or the asset manager, your job is to make sure everyone understands the vision, but give them enough flexibility to create their portion to achieve that goal. but it's not to micromanage. And it took a minute to process that I didn't have to be the know-it-all in every single area, right? I didn't have to understand construction to the point where I could argue that this should be $1.27 a square foot, still $1.15 a square foot, right? What I had to do was get the right person who understood how to control costs, how to hit our budget, and how to be efficient. I obviously need to have a little bit of knowledge on everything just so I could keep everybody accountable and keep them all on track. But I didn't have to be the master of everything. So I think that's the biggest lesson I learned is I didn't have to be the master of everything. I just had to be really good at the things that I was taking on, but also really good at building a team. And if you can build a team, you talked about real estate being the ultimate team sport. Mm-hmm. Part of it is being a great general manager, right? And being able to identify talent, bringing those team members onto your team, and being able to understand what they need to be successful and then giving them those resources.
There's a lot of opportunities that exist out there in the marketplace. You turn over a whole bunch of stones before you find one. What's your investment philosophy? What separates a deal from an opportunity for you?
That's a great question. For me, it's looking at a high floor. A lot of times people look at deals where, oh, we can hit a 3 equity multiple, or we can hit a 30, 25, 30% IRR. Mm-hmm. And that's great. But part of what I'm looking at is capital preservation, first and foremost. I want to know, how can we lose money? What would need to happen in order for us to lose money? And then I want to take that and really just assess, okay, how likely is that to happen? For instance, we focus mainly on a value add strategy, where we're looking at deals that are cash flowing today, or at least making money today, but we could come in and do something to create more value. So that maybe and typically is renovating the units. It could be charging for different services. It could be reducing some of the expenses or renegotiating contracts. But ultimately, I'm trying to drive the NOI, right? I'm trying to take it from wherever it's at today to a higher NOI so we create this value. For us, if the property is cash flowing when we buy it, then hopefully that's our floor, right? And worst case scenario, if we're not able to drive rents as much, or we're not able to increase the value as much, we still have a property that pays its own bills. When you buy something that, say, is more of a development deal, or it's a gut rehab project, well, now you don't have the income coming in to cover the expenses. And that's where I think there's a bit more risk and danger, just because you don't have that money coming in. Now, certainly there's skilled contractors and skilled project managers and teams that can do that. But for us, our investing philosophy is capital preservation first and foremost, which is looking at deals that cash flow that still have upside potential. And for the upside, we're looking at a few different factors, right? We're looking at the market itself. So what city are we in? What are the demographic trends? What are we seeing as far as people moving, jobs moving, overall industries? What are we seeing there, right? The other thing is, what's the competition? Do we have clear comps that are doing something that we could be doing? Can we identify a clear business plan? Do we see proof points in the marketplace that says residents will pay for this, or residents are looking for this, and we can go out there and create it? So if we can find those things, then we feel pretty comfortable going out there and making an investment. So typically we're looking at something that is already making some money. Again, maybe it's underutilized or not making as much money as it could, but it's making some money. And then we want to have a clear path to growth.
Are you a passive real estate investor seeking financial freedom? Well, today's market's unique and it's ever changing. Now is the time to get educated on how to strategically invest in commercial real estate for long-term financial freedom. Grab your copy of How to Passively Invest in a Changing Economic Environment. Go to www.mavericksinvest.com. When you bring investors on, they invest alongside you. What's that communication plan look like? How do you communicate with them? What's the frequency of communication?
Yeah, we do monthly communications with our investors. Obviously, the upfront portion, it's going to be a little different. So there we may be talking to them weekly or every other week or whatever it is based on where the deal is. But once we close on a deal, close on the asset, we send out monthly communications to those investors. And we always tell them, hey, listen, if you have a question or a question about either the update or something else, feel free to reach out. So we try to make ourselves available. I know some groups like set it and forget it, but that's not really our approach. We want to be present and we want to offer that value and that service. And I think that comes from kind of my time in corporate America. When I was on the agency side, my job was to be really the liaison between the agency, and really that's our strategic team and our creatives and our clients. So what did the client want? What are they looking for? What did the creatives want to come up with? And helping everybody get on the same page. So in the same way, I look at it here where we're talking to our investors, we're giving them updates on the investment, what our business plan is, what we're doing with our project managers, our property managers, our contractors, and making sure they're kind of aware of where things have been, but also where things are going.
When a passive investor, they're evaluating general partners, they're looking not yet at the deal, but looking at the people. What types of things should they be paying attention to? Maybe what are a couple of the red flags that would send me moving on to the next conversation to see if I better align with somebody else?
That's a great one. So there are multiple things to look at. I'll give you a couple really important ones. So first and foremost, and I'm going to speak high level here. The first thing you want to do is get a sense of their communication style. How often are they going to communicate with you? What are they going to communicate with you? And I would go off of what they have actually done. You can ask them, hey, can you send me some of your previous deal updates? Or maybe they have a reference or referral, another investor that you can speak with. And you can find out from them, like, hey, are they communicative? Do they share information with you? But you want to understand that. One really big red flag for me, I learned this kind of the hard way on the other side of that table. You want someone who respects you. And what I mean by this is you may not understand apartment investing or real estate investing as much as that operator or that syndicator, but you still have value. You still have knowledge, right? You've listened to podcasts like this. You've read books or articles or whatever it is. You have some frame of reference for the questions you have. Never discredit your experience and your knowledge. I remember working with a flipper. We were flipping a house and I was the investor. He was the flipper and contractor. And everything I'd ever read about flipping was like the 70% rule, right? You buy a property for 70% of the ARV and all in 70%. And this house in particular, we're looking to do, I think the numbers were closer to like 82%. So I asked him about it, but I had never flipped a house in my life, right? Who am I to tell this guy how to do it? And I asked him about it and he kind of just brushed it off. Oh, don't worry about that. And then he was growing his portfolio of projects he was taking on, but his team wasn't growing. And I was like, hey, man, how are you going to manage the growth of these projects? When I met you, you were doing 3 projects at a time. You're now to 6 projects, but you haven't added any contractors. You haven't added any laborers. And he again dismissed it and told me, hey, don't worry about that. We got it. We're going to grow it. Sure enough, I should have worried about it. Like, that's exactly what happened. It went down. The project stalled and everything collapsed, right? And I say that and I share that story because your concerns should be validated. And even if it's a silly concern that is a newbie question, whatever you want to call it, you should be able to get honest feedback. So if you were to ask a question, that operator should tell you, hey, you know what? That's a great question. Or you know what? Hey, here's why that won't impact us. But they should answer and address your concern directly and clearly and not dismiss it. If they don't do that, then they don't respect you and I would not invest with that individual.
Talk to me about how you're borrowing today, maybe on a forward-looking basis, maybe with a larger question be, how do you see the world, the environment today that we're in from an investment standpoint as it relates to multifamily and then specifically debt as well?
It's a great question, right? The market's ever changing and most people assume it's going to go down again before it goes up. One of the great things about what we talked about with our investing philosophy, right? Focusing on kind of that floor before you focus on the ceiling is you have to have a little bit more of a longer term view, right? We're not trying to time the market. I'm not trying to get in now and get out in 12 months. So we can take that longer view. So what I would say is I'm a little less concerned with the market at any one moment in time, more concerned with controlling when I exit. So we are always looking to buy or us looking to buy for whatever the value is in that time frame. But we want to have more control over the exit. So when we think about the lending environment, that means having loans that are flexible, that may allow us to either refinance if rates drop, that may allow us to stay in a deal a little bit longer or keep that loan in place if interest rates rise. We want to have some flexibility. And that's really key for us is having that longer term view and being able to decide when we sell or when we refinance. I think where people get in trouble is when they try to time the market or they go into it with either assumptions or they really need the market to be in a certain place. They need interest rates to be at a certain place at a time. So if you've got a 2-year loan and you have to refinance no matter what in 2 years, well, now you're completely subject to the market, right? You have no flexibility. You have no options.
Yeah. Operators who are too rigid.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're stuck, right? You're hoping at that point. Yeah. You're hoping you're right. You're hoping the market is in your favor. But if you have flexibility, if you've created the loans or you created your business plan, where you have that flexibility, I think you'll be okay. And I want to be really clear here. The loan is a part of the business plan. I know some people say, oh, you should never have a variable loan. That's not true. You need to have a loan that matches the business plan.
Right.
If you're going to create a ton of value in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, you may want to have flexibility to tap into the equity you've created. So in that case, a variable rate loan does make sense. Now, you need to factor in, like, again, the triggers and, well, how high do interest rates need to go in order for this to be a bad decision? But that makes sense with the business plan. if you're not creating a lot of value, or you're not certain that you're going to create a ton of value in that time frame, then you may want to have more of a fixed rate loan where you're not worried about how much value you create in this time frame. So I think the business plan is really, really important. And too often people go straight to the loan without matching that loan to the business plan, and vice versa. I mean, that very first syndication deal we did, it worked out well. And we locked in, I think, a 12 or 7-year term on that first deal because we were all concerned. The rate was a 5.3% interest rate. And of course, rates dropped. But we were locked into this 5.3% interest rate. We had people willing to buy this property from us, but the prepayment penalty really, it didn't allow that to happen.
Sure. Yeah.
It was huge, right? So that was one of the things we learned is like, yes, fixed rates are good from that standpoint, but you do also want to have some flexibility because if you succeed or you implement your business plan in that time frame, you want to be able to cash out. So it really depends on the business plan and the loan, not just the loan product by itself.
What are you most excited about this year?
I'm excited for growth, man, and opportunities. And I think it's easy to look at the interest rate environment or other situations and get maybe down, but there's going to be opportunities. We keep talking about that. We know there's going to be opportunities. And for us, I really am excited about some of the deals we're going to be able to do based on the opportunities that are presenting themselves. I just toured another asset yesterday that looks promising, a little bit different from the kind of deal we typically do, just a little bit older, but it's been very well maintained by a great group. So we're excited about stuff like that because for us, especially in the Midwest, deals don't trade hands as often as maybe in, you know, Florida or Texas, right? Those deals kind of trade hands all the time. So for us to get those quality assets that have been owned by a group for 10, 15, 20 years, it's a little more rare, but some of those groups are recognizing that, you know what, hey, we want to reposition our portfolio and we're starting to see some of those come up on the market. So I'm excited to try to get our hands on some of those.
Let's do this. I'm going to move on to the final segment, what I call the final four. What do you think holds most passive investors back from hitting their personal next level, whatever that happens to be?
Ooh, that's a great question. I would say clarity. You know, clarity of their goal and then clarity of the next step to get there. People always tell me, they say stuff like, oh, you are so brave for investing or for doing this or for doing that. I'm like, you got to understand, I was miserable every day for about a year at GM. Had nothing to do with the company. I actually loved my time there. But when your future is playing out on TV and it's the face of what's happening in the country, and you turn on the news and you literally see your boss's boss on there, that anxiety forces you into action. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people don't get the push they need to take action. I felt like I was thrown out there, right? Like, yeah. Rich Dad, Poor Dad was a book I read before. And like many people, would have been a nice book with a lot of great ideas.
Right.
But when I was going through bankruptcy at that company, I was like, man, you better go read that book again and do something about it. Yeah. And I would say that I was fortunate, I guess, to go through that experience because it really did push me to take action. So I think getting that clarity is really important as a passive investor so you can take the appropriate action.
Outside of real estate, what are you passionate about?
Man, you know what? I love coaching. So I coach other real estate investors, but I also coach my boys in some of their sports and activities. So I don't know if you can see it up here, but I got a picture there of my
my
K-1 football team that I was coaching, where they're in second grade now. So it's just fun, man. You see the growth that people have, adults to kids. I mean, I was just talking with my clients earlier today and we were working through a deal and I was just showing them some different ways to get creative with it to still make it work before he just throws it out.
Right.
And just watching the impact that can have on someone. And my son, he came home yesterday to tell me one of the other kids on his team, they play at recess together. He's like, oh, this kid can really catch. And we had practice last night. So I was like, well, let's test him out and see. So I told the kid his dad was over there. He was like, he can? Oh, I want to see this too. So I'm like, all right, let's get out here and see it. But that's, it was just fun. And the kid did a great job. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to have to put something in the playbook for you. But I love coaching and just seeing the growth that not just young people, but people in general, but especially those kids can make.
Yeah. Your favorite book?
Ooh, man. I always say Atomic Habits. So I was trying to see if I could find another one, but I'm going to say Atomic Habits. And it's just because I love the simplicity and the clearness of it. And it is probably the first book that I read that was, I don't know if you call it motivational or self-help, whatever it is, but it's the first one I've read that it was easy to implement immediately. Most books, you're like, all right, cool, I'm gonna go write my goals and then I'm gonna go do this and I'm gonna sign up for this class. This book was like, you want to be a runner, put your shoes on. Like, literally, just go put your shoes on, take that first step, right? You don't have to go running,
right?
Just put your shoes on and that's the first step. And you can just say, hey, you know, for 10 days straight, I'm just gonna put on my shoes, I'm gonna get dressed, and that's gonna be the first, and eventually you'll go out and run. So I just love that aspect. I keep these bowls on my
Yeah.
My desk, these are for calls I'm supposed to make to investors, and I put marbles in there, and it's a reminder for me to make my calls. Once I make a call, I can move one over. So that came straight from the book, right? It's just a little, a mind thing, a reminder to help you hit your goals.
Your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
I am an advisory board member for an organization called Surge for Water, and we invest in sustainable water solutions in underdeveloped countries. So we're in Uganda, the Philippines, we are in Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. And we just had our annual gala last week. We raised over $250,000. And the thing that's crazy is the woman who started used to work with my wife, and she left corporate America to do this full time. No money for like the first 3 years. She wasn't even taking any money at all. And all this work was going into the field. It goes directly into the field. So I'm extremely passionate about supporting this mission, just because we really take for granted how much water is a vital resource. And she said something at the gala, and I'll leave this with your audience, but she said, the work we're doing in Uganda, the gold standard of what we can do as an impact is to have one water tap for 300 residents. And that's within a 1.6 mile radius, basically 2 kilometer radius. Mm. If you think about your own home and think about how many water taps do you have, that's the faucets you have, that's the tubs, that's the toilets, just any place where water flows. Mm. How many of those do you have? For them, their goal is to have one where 300 people can utilize that. And then think about how many you have in your own house, right? Yeah. So that's the gold standard in some of these communities. And that's the work we're trying to do. It's not like we're putting brass toilets in these communities, but we're just trying to get access, because what happens is a lot of women in particular, but young girls, they have to miss school because they have to actually be the ones who go out, walk 3 to 5 miles, get the water, walk 3 to 5 miles back so that their family and their community can have some water. So it's a great organization. Surge for Water is the name. Surge, S-U-R-G-E. I'm really passionate about that group and all the work that we're doing there.
John, it's been an incredible conversation. Your background's amazing and sounds like it certainly has served you well going through all the advertising and all your experiences at GM to help propel and catapult you forward, kind of proverbial kick in the tit, if you will, that helps move someone forward. And then all the success you've had putting things together. For people, they want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect with you, they want to listen to the podcast, where can they go? What should they do?
Yeah, so you can go to kasmancapital.com, and we have a couple things there. The podcast is there, Multifamily Insights, and that's available anywhere you listen to podcasts. On our site, we also have a sample deal package. And if you are either A, trying to wrap your head around passive investing and just want to see what a deal package looks like, I think it's a great resource just because you can see some of the terminology that people use. You ask questions about how to vet a deal sponsor. We actually have a follow-up piece that gives you, I think, 7 questions to ask whenever you're evaluating a deal. So I think that's a really good piece that you can check out there. And there's more information on our website as well, but just go to kasmancapital.com and you'll get access to some of those different resources.
Links below in the show notes for everybody. John, I appreciate your time. Wonderful having you here.
Neil, thanks for having me today.
Thanks so much. To our listeners, pat yourself on the back. You guys have made it to the end of the show, and most people never finish what they start. If you receive value from today's show, be sure to share it on LinkedIn, your Facebook page, or your social media platform of choice. Subscribe to never miss a valuable episode in the future. And if you found value in today's episode, give us a thumbs up with a positive review. If there's a particular topic you'd like to hear about, well, I want to hear from you. Shoot me a message on LinkedIn. The link to my profile is below in the show notes. You can connect with me there for more valuable content.